This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. In the past year, Laurie Metcalf has appeared in a hit television show, Roseanne, was nominated for an Oscar for her appearance in Lady Bird, and won two Tonys, one last week and one the year before. Joe Mantello, who directed her in Three Tall Women, her current play, described Metcalf as a monster in the room. She was still at Illinois State when she met the actors with whom she started one of the world's great theater companies. But Steppenwolf was still just a group of friends putting on plays in a church. It took a couple of years for her to abandon her day job as a legal secretary who could type 120 words a minute. She's best known for her role as Jackie, Roseanne's younger sister, but she's also appeared in The Norm Show, Getting On, The Big Bang Theory, to name just a few. Laurie Metcalf has been nominated for Emmy Awards 10 times, winning 3. But even after so many years on television sets, it's the stage that Laurie Metcalf calls home.
I have a phobia of the camera. A lot of people like to work with the camera and they understand it, actors. They know exactly how much to give the camera, and the camera is their friend. And to me, it just becomes this thing in the room that I have to pretend like
factor
isn't
in.
There. Yes, mm-hmm. Factor in, which just makes me self-conscious, and I don't feel as free as I do on a stage.
One of the joys of doing films is working with great camera people, cinematographers and their crew. And I've worked with some of the greatest cinematographers in history, you know, of my generation, of my time. But they would say to me, we're going to do this. Here's this shot. We're going to do it in this lens. And very early on, I had this kind of silly habit of saying to them, I really don't care what lens you're on.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to affect what I'm going to do.
Mm-hmm.
If there's a thing I do, I'm going to do it that way. Now, should I tone it down? Should I make it bigger, smaller, whatever, to play to the camera?
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself incapable of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel the same way?
Yeah, but and maybe that's what the piece that I'm missing. I've done so few films that I've never had been able to develop that relationship with a cinematographer. So maybe that would be the missing piece that would put me more at ease, you know, that I knew that somebody was watching out for it and was giving me, you know, advice, too big, too small, or I don't even know what else it would be. But
right.
I just,
it's really pretty much that.
I can sort of gauge what I'm doing on a stage and in front of a camera, I can't tell at all. If the director says, well, we're moving on, or do you want one more? I always say, oh, let's just move on, because I don't know what we've got. I'm assuming you know that you got it, and so I have no clue.
How did the experience of shooting Lady Bird come about? They found you?
Yeah, I think I was on Scott Rudin's radar, and the producer, and he suggested me to Greta Gerwig, and Greta sent me the script, and I read it and really responded to the material. And then she and I had a quick phone conversation and hit it off over the phone. And it was a very small independent movie. And so I thought, well, I haven't done a movie in about 10 years, so this will be a nice little way to put my toe back in the water and see how it is.
Why hadn't you made a movie in 10 years?
Nobody asked me.
I find that hard to believe.
It's true.
Or were you living a life where you appeared unavailable? Were you traveling and doing plays and out of town in London?
That's partly true, yeah. I had been doing a lot of theater.
They forget about you when they don't see you.
That's true, yeah. Yeah.
Take my word for it.
Yeah. So, and then when it exploded, when Lady Bird exploded, that was unprepared for. I had no idea what that publicity circus train was that you have to get on, you know, and ride for about 3 months.
How was she as a director?
Up to all
for
the
you?
Awards seasons. I think I'm spoiled for life working with her.
Yeah.
She had done all the heavy lifting on the script itself. So the script was in such good shape that there were never those days when you get on the set and everybody's looking at each other saying, this doesn't really work. What would you say here? You know, there was never that scramble or that uncertainty. Everything was crystal clear from day one. And Greta's just a natural at it. She gives the kind of notes that click with an actor and are doable rather than get in your head and mess you up.
Right.
Yeah. And where you start second guessing, well, I thought I was doing the line that way, but they're telling me to do it differently. So now what do I do? And then you just shut down. You just become paralyzed. You're
even
all in your head.
Whether it's television, which you've done quite a bit of, or film, had you worked with a woman director before?
Yeah, I have.
Film, had you worked with one?
Well, no, not in film, because I just haven't done that much.
A lot of female directors in TV, though.
Yeah, and theater. Uh-huh. Yeah. And the TV that I've done, though, has been limited also, because it's been sitcoms mostly.
So it's guys.
You know, for camera. Some women directors, but just that – it's just that style. You know, I've done very little single camera TV. So this four camera sitcom style is also very different. A different beast, definitely from theater and film. And that was a huge learning curve for me also, stepping into Roseanne 30 years ago when we did the pilot. My God.
but when you do the
film.
Yeah,
let's ease into that.
We had a long way to go. And then but when you work, is there a difference for you when you work with a woman director and a man director?
Honestly, I think it just boils down to the person. And with this person, there was a feminine vibe, I will say, with Greta, because she's very maternal. And you felt, I think everybody in the cast and crew felt very well protected, cherished, listened to. But
safe.
Very safe. And I can label that, you know, because she's a woman, or I can just label it because it's Greta, you know, just the person.
You grew up in Illinois?
Southern Illinois.
And what did your dad do?
Comptroller at Illinois State University.
And what did your mom do?
She was a librarian.
And there were how many kids in your family?
Just three.
How many boys, how many girls?
Oh, I'm the oldest, and then a sister and a brother.
A sister and a brother. Yeah. Any of them go in show business?
No.
How did you get started
in
show
don't
business?
Know. I used to put on records of musicals and lip sync to them.
And fly through the air around the house.
In the backyard on a swing set or just like lip syncing to Gypsy in the living room. Not even for anybody to watch, just to do it. I don't know. But so that was in me. But it wasn't about performing it. It was sort of about a feeling of interpreting it, using their singing. And just mouthing it, but feeling like I was interpreting it. Something about that clicked with me. But then I was much too practical to go into theater in college.
So I
thought I'd never make a living at it. So
where'd you go to college?
Illinois State University.
What'd you study?
German. And the most practical of all.
Wow.
But because
so you
can I thought
those German musicals. You lip sync those German musicals.
Well, but I thought I'd be a translator. You know, so there was something about language that I liked.
Was there German in your family?
Nah, I don't think so. Not that I know of.
What's going on with that little Lori when she's spinning around in that swing set? What's she thinking? German?
Well, we had a choice of two languages to pick in high school. I picked that one, and I liked it. Right. I ended up liking the language. There are definite rules to it. It's very rigid, and I like that.
It's reliable.
It is. Yeah. And then fell in with the group that became Steppenwolf.
At Illinois State?
Yes.
Who was there?
That's what happened. Jeff Perry, Terry Kinney, John Malkovich, Joan
Allen.
They
were going to school there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All those people, I didn't even know this. All of them went to school down there?
Joan
and Terry?
Joan
and
didn't.
And Malkovich?
Joan didn't go to school there. Terry, Jeff Perry, and Malkovich all went there. Gary Sinise was up in Highland Park. He didn't go to college, so he was like our
bad boy,
our wingman,
for
being up in Highland Park and scoring us, you know, a place where
working
we could
on his
do
motorcycle.
Where we could do our sad little one acts. Joan did come into the group later. She did not go to Illinois State.
Who did you meet first?
Terry Kinney, and then Jeff, and then John.
And you met them where? You met them in a class, in an acting class, or on the street, or?
I was.
How does that group know they want to become Steppenwolf?
Yeah, I know. I was actually dabbling in theater, but I was, you know, I was a German major, so wasn't going to go down the theater route. I was Terry's girlfriend. And so I got brought into the mix as the girlfriend, and then that's how I got introduced to everybody.
And what did you do first? Did you all say, let's form a group, a theater group, or that came later?
We said, let's form a theater group for the summer, for one summer.
What year?
78.
Okay.
And we found a church basement who charged us, you know, a dollar a month, and we built some risers and put some chairs in there and did four one acts and thought, well, that'll be it.
Right.
But then we thought, let's do another one, and then another and another. So there was no plan. It just evolved.
When did it change?
Probably changed, I would say, like about 5 years later when we were able to quit our day jobs and join Equity and then also move into the city, into a place.
A space you found that became the Steppenwolf Theater.
We found a space first that was in a Jane Addams Hull House that we rented. And then from there, we moved. It took over from a group called St. Nicholas Theater. Took over their space, and then by that time we had built up a really good board, and with their backing, we were able to build a place from scratch, from the ground up, literally, which we're still in now.
They're still there.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in New York, you hear about Steppenwolf. I remember when that takes off. You know, when in New York, everybody was like, they talked about Steppenwolf like it was heroin. You know what I mean? Like it was like the chicest thing.
They Well, the first thing that happened was that Malkovich and Gary Sinise brought in True West.
That was the first one.
That was the first one that traveled to New York. Yeah. And then after that, it was Balm and Gilead.
Right.
And that one came in and ran for like 9 months and was everybody was talking about it. And it was such a cool time to be in New York. That was 83, I think. And we had music in that show by Springsteen, Ricky Lee Jones, and Tom Waits. They all came to see the show. You know, it was wild.
Where did you do Balm and Gilead? Off-Broadway?
Yeah, at Circle Rep. It's gone now, but
the one downtown?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did Prelude to a Kiss down there.
Yeah.
The one down on Sheridan Square.
Yeah,
Tanya Barrison.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I sublet her apartment.
I remember that when you were in New York, and people couldn't stop talking about you guys.
It was just a different style. It was different. It was a,
how would you describe it?
Well, they called it rock and roll theater, but I think it was just a shared passion that we had that made us just light up on stage.
Less conventional staging.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I remember about them.
Yes. And those plays were perfect vehicles for that.
And dark.
Yes.
Some of them.
And funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of the mix of like a Martin McDonagh show.
He's got a bit of Steppenwolf in him.
Yeah, and theatrical.
Yeah.
That's what they were. They didn't back off. It wasn't trying to be super realistic or supernatural. Balm and Gilead had some really strong theatrical moments in it where lights would go out and a spotlight would hit a character and everybody's frozen and you'd hear the character say two lines and then the lights pop back up again and you're in a diner and it would come to life again, you know.
What's a show that really stands out that you did back then that you always remember? What's a performance you gave? If you close your eyes, you can remember where you were and what you were holding and what you were wearing.
Yeah, I've got a number of them, I think. That was certainly one. And even before then was a production of Glass Menagerie that we did way back in that little basement with Malkovich was Tom and Terry Kinney was a gentleman caller. And we had a local woman who was played Amanda. And that was the production that made we were out in the suburbs that made critics in town sit up and take notice of the Steppenwolf company, and they would start driving up, you know, to see our shows. It was I don't know what made it different. It was like John didn't try to hide that Tom was gay and desperately, you know, lonely and wanting to meet somebody, and I didn't try to hide that Laura was not mentally ill, you know, and that there was clearly no hope at all. It wasn't, sometimes it can be played like a young, pretty girl who if she's
just fragile.
Fragile and
these
if she
vague terms that
yes, and if she had a nice dress.
Let's make a real choice here.
Yeah. Make the ballsier choice, you know.
The tougher choice.
Yes. Yeah.
Now you were dating Kinney, he was your boyfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And does that end in the middle of the ascension of?
Well, we were a very insular group, and so there was a lot of mixing and matching.
Right. like in a rock band. You're like Fleetwood
yes.
Mac.
Yeah, we were.
You're all sleeping with each other.
Yes, yeah.
You're all
basically,
buddies.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so you...
But which made a lot of also awkward infighting and, you know,
yes.
I can't be in that play because, you know, I've just now broken up with him, so, you know,
yeah.
I'm going to have to look somewhere else. But, yeah, no, in that sense, it was also a very theatrical time. You know, the highs are highs and the lows
right.
are low.
You were as crazy off stage
we
as
were
you were
all
on.
Crazy. All we wanted to do was hang out together, make each other either laugh or cry. But we took the work part very seriously. And that made us all better, you know, because we were having to play parts we wouldn't be cast in anywhere else because we were all the same age and we couldn't find plays, you know, that would accommodate that. I'd have to be the mom in Malkovich's mom in True West, and then I'd have to be his little niece in The 5th of July.
You had to cover the gamut.
Yeah, so we ultimately ended up stretching ourselves into areas that we had no business going into.
Now, would you say that it kind of unravels and everybody, they start to come apart because stardom intervenes? Who's the first person that becomes a star?
Malkovich.
And what's the first thing he stars in?
Oh, we did that movie with Sally Field. He played a blind character. He made chairs.
Places in the Heart.
That's the movie that took him out of the mix for a while. And believe me, I mean, we were so naive and so inbred and everything at that point. It's like John had this offer to go be in a movie, and we all had a big company meeting about it, deciding whether or not to let him do it.
Can John have his out?
Yes. Yes.
Did anyone vote not to let him leave?
Probably. I don't remember. You know, because we did our voting like little kids, we would put our heads down on the table and raise our hands. And whoever had to be artistic director at that time, because that was a thankless, worthless job. Nobody
votes.
Wanted that. Had to count the votes. Yeah. So John got to go do it. But that's how you know.
And then he came back and what happened?
Naive.
I'm interested in a group like that.
I think that was before True West. I think he made that movie before it. I'm not sure of the timeline of that. But we were – so – because we started out in a little suburb and because we very slowly made our way into the city and because we were centered around Chicago and not L.A. or New York, people kind of left us alone for a lot longer because they would have swooped in if we were on the coast and just taken everybody
away.
You were
a little more inaccessible.
Yes, we were. Yes, we were.
More protective even.
Yes. So that helped us get some more traction as a group. They left us alone for a longer time.
But after Places in the Heart, did he become less and less available?
Well, we all started to.
You all started to follow.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it was a big deal that we en masse took Balmy-Gilead to New York. That was a big learning experience for us all. And I ended up making a movie, Desperately Seeking Susan, because I was in town. But for me, that didn't spiral out into, you know, a lot more movie or a movie career, obviously. But we were starting to very slowly as a group, but also individually, starting to get known. And we became more available because we were adding people to the company, and that made us more available to take time off, go off and do a different project, and then return. But for a decade, we all tried a lot to return and rejuvenate, you know, get our batteries charged on that stage again. Yes, it definitely was home.
Who else has come up through the ranks of there? Anybody else I would know? Did that success replicate itself with future generations of people? Or you guys it? And nobody else ever really became famous after that?
Boy, I'd have to – do you know John Hill?
No.
He's a young actor that you would recognize. He's taken off after having come into the company. Sally Murphy has done a lot of work here in New York. She's in a play right now called Admissions, I think. I'd have to look. You know, the list has gotten big. There's like 40 people in the company now. And it's tough for us to get – I haven't been back in 5 years. You know, it's tough to go back and mm-hmm. commit to – 4 or 5 months mm-hmm. out of a year. And because we're on a subscription season, they want to know, like, at least a year in advance when you can, you know, rope off that time. It's hard to...
I find segregating that time and protecting that time to do a show is very difficult. The last show I did was with you when we did the show in 2015. When you came to New York, what was your first show on Broadway?
On Broadway? It was November, written by David Mamet.
The Mamet play, yeah.
Yeah, with Nathan Lane,
right.
Directed by Joe Mantel.
Right.
And it was a small part, and I just wanted to be in the room with those people, those specific
people.
That
was the political one.
Yeah. Yeah, which
I
would love to revisit that now because, you know, it's just this idiot sitting in the set with the Oval Office. I need to go back and read that, or we need to do it like as a benefit, you know, just do a reading of it. It's wicked funny and more timely now than ever.
That was your first show on Broadway?
Yeah.
Did you feel that Broadway was different?
Yeah, I did. I mean, it's, you know, it's the same amount of work that you put in, whether it's there or at Guildhall or even a smaller space, like for 50 seats, you know. The work is the same. You're still doing, you're putting in 150% and you want it the best that it can be. And you never give up working on it during the whole run. But yeah, it's startling to walk out on a set that big. And we went from the rehearsal room to invited dress, and it was packed with 1,000 actors, you know, and that was a—
Friends and family.
Yes, that was quite a shock. That was my first time there. But I got burned on a show called Brighton Beach Memoirs that was supposed to open up in rep with Broadway Bound, and I'd never done rep before. So I thought, oh, this will be really interesting, and it's on Broadway, so I can be in New York, and it's these two plays go really well together. Neil Simon, it's the same family, but a decade later. And I don't think
Matthew.
He ever— Yes. Well, he wasn't in it.
He wasn't.
No. But I don't think that Neil Simon ever meant them to go together in rep, but they just— – it was a natural. Everything turned out wrong about it. They opened up one and expected it to take off, and it didn't. And then the other one, we had fully rehearsed it, and we had the costumes. We had everything. And it never even saw the light of day. And the first one closed after 3 weeks, and it was— – that was a huge low. I had— relocated not my family, but one of my kids out, had them in school.
This was a revival of the material.
Yes, and I was trying, and I had signed off for a year, thinking, okay, well, these things are going to run for that long, and after 3 weeks, well, a rehearsal period, and then 3 weeks, you know, we have a toast on stage. You know, well, this didn't work. Sorry, everybody, bye. And then I was stuck with this apartment in New York and my kid in school, and I would just like take him to school and then walk up and down the sidewalks thinking, what the hell am I going to do?
Right.
What am I
do?
It was really depressing.
How long did you end up being stuck there?
I was stuck with no work for about a month, and then for some reason, Ethan Hawke gave me a call and said, well, there's no money here at all, but you want to come down and do A Lie of the Mind with us down at the group theater. So that was something to work on, and that got me out of my head, you know. Ugh.
I talked to Lori a couple of months ago, just before the recent cancellation of Roseanne. After it all happened, I called to get her take on ABC's decision. Lori declined to comment. Coming up, we talk about what it was like to gather the team, cast, and crew together again. This is Alec Baldwin, and you're listening to Here's the Thing. Although Laurie Metcalf's heart is in the theater, she's always cautious about what roles she chooses.
I did a roll of the dice last year.
What'd you do?
Doll's House Part 2.
Right. And that went well.
It went well.
And you got some sensational reviews for that.
Yes. But I didn't know it was a roll of the dice, because when Scott Rudin sent me the script, and I thought, this is either going to be really, really funny and clever or really bad.
Yeah.
The nerve that it takes to name your play A Doll's House Part 2. And Lucas Nath, I knew of him as a writer, but I didn't know him. And I knew of Sam Gold as a director, but I hadn't worked with him. And the play wasn't finished. I mean, it was finished, but it was really raw, and that we were going to do workshops, and so it's scary to go out on that limb and commit yourself to something that you have no idea how it's going to turn out. But it had Scott Rudin behind it, so I knew that it would be taken care of.
When you and I did The Miller together, mm-hmm. you'd done it a couple times before, mm-hmm. and one of them was in London, correct?
Yeah.
Was it different for you there? You find the difference between performing there and in the United States?
Well, I did because it was at the National. So the National is so specific. I loved the vibe that there's these three theaters, the big, the medium, and the small one, and they all feed into this communal lobby. And there's a great restaurant there, and everybody's having drinks before their show. And then the whole place just sort of evaporate. Everybody goes into their certain theater that they're seeing and then regroups at intermission and then back again. It's got a real flow to it that way. So I felt it was cool to be a part of that specific building.
British cast mixed in with an American cast for when you did The Miller over there?
It was mostly British.
Mostly British.
Yes.
A difference in the way that they act, rehearse? Do they have a different approach? Would you say it's the opposite of the Steppenwolf approach?
I wouldn't call it rock and roll.
Right.
Well, yeah.
Or string quartet.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I like to be really theatrical if I can find moments.
Right. Where the character's theatrical.
Yes, exactly.
How much is the character acting?
Yes, we built in some ourselves, you know, where there's a shove. Things that aren't expected.
Right.
Those are theatrical if they're not expected, I guess.
Right. And try them.
Yeah, yeah.
When we did All My Sons, we remember we had Chris choke me.
Yeah.
Remember, he would choke me.
Yeah.
And we all thought, I don't know if we should do that. I loved it.
Yeah, I do too.
I thought it was fantastic.
I do too, because sometimes the trap when you're working on a classic that is, you feel like you have to treat it with kid gloves. You know, you feel like you shouldn't make those big choices. That you should be more reverential towards the material. Mm-hmm. But that keeps it from being alive mm-hmm. and seeming contemporary. I always wanted to sneak a camera on stage with me for the very last moments of our play because I had the best ringside seat available to watch your last monologue. I wish I had done it because I'd like to have a record of it, but of course I never did. But I loved watching that every night.
Well, you're very kind. It's a great ending.
Sure is.
It's a great ending, you know. Mm. Now, you did another play right after that. You left that show to go do the Stephen King.
Oh, yes. And I asked your advice on that. Do you remember?
Well, but when you do plays with people who, this is you doing
Misery.
Misery with Bruce Willis, who hadn't mm-hmm. done a play in how long? Like 30?
40.
40. Mm-hmm. He hadn't been on stage in 40 years. Did he like turn to you like a life preserver and say, "You got to help me, baby. I'm going to be leaning on you, baby."
Yeah.
Was there some of that?
Well, we were codependent on each other
right.
because it was basically two people.
That's it.
There was a sheriff that showed up, but I shot him dead, you know, right. towards the end.
He's not around for very long.
No, he's not. No. So it was just the two of us. And we, you know, we relied on each other very much. And Bruce worked his ass off.
Did he have a good time?
Yes. He had a wonderful time.
Did.
Yeah. Thank God. I was worried because, you know, I didn't know if your co-lead is having a bad time,
right.
you know, it's everybody's miserable.
Right.
But Bruce would show up, you know, like an hour and a half early before the shows. Of course, he had to get into a bunch of body makeup because he'd been, you know, in an accident and he's got his head's all banged up and he's got cuts and scars all over his legs. So he was always the first one there. We would do, you know, like a 7 straight-hour rehearsal day, and then he would go home with the dialect coach and drill lines over and over and over again. He really, really cared about it, and audiences ate it up. Mm. You know, they
good crowds.
It was a different crowd than I've ever performed for because it was a lot of first-time theater goers because they wanted to see Bruce. They wanted to see an action hero on stage,
right.
and if they had to go to theater to see him live, then they went to the theater. So these were people that hadn't been before, let alone on Broadway.
Right.
And the play itself you know, it stemmed from the book and then it went through the movie version and now they're trying to do it as a play. So it was this odd
journey.
Yeah, and it ended up being half this, half that, not any part of that though, and it just was its own animal. So we tried
Who directed that?
Will Frears, okay. Stephen Frears'
son.
We tried to make it also as funny as it could be because there was a lot of oddball humor in it. And audiences got a kick out of that. But it was kind of a learning curve for me to wrap my head around the fact that, you know, if the script never was perfect, if we were never perfect in it, the audience was still having a ball. Right. And feeling like they were getting their money's worth.
What theater were you in?
I always forget all the names of
them. It was a big house?
Yeah, really big. 1,200, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and it sold well. He sold the tickets.
No, I'm sure. I'm sure. When you think about plays, think about a moment, and I'm sure there's many of them, but try to think about a moment of you on stage with someone or another group of people, and in terms of what acting means to you.
Well,
what was one that you just never can get out of your head? You thought, this is it. This is what it's about. This is what I got into this for.
I don't know. I'm not going to say a specific thing, but it's the feeling of being in such control that you know that you've got a moment coming up and it's like a big softball this big coming at you you've got a bat this big and you're going to hit it out of the park.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. It's coming and boom, you get to do it and you hear the immediate reaction from the audience, whether it's a laugh or whether it's a sob, whatever it is.
Listening.
Or whether it's you can hear a pin drop and it's that control, I think. And you've done your homework and you know exactly what you're doing in that moment. And you know it's going to be a surprise to them. And you know you'd like to be in the audience with this thing coming up. And it's, I love that moment.
I always tell people when you see a play that I've ever been in, I ruin the play for the people with me. Because I'll lean over and I'll go, I didn't do it that way. I had this thing I used to do with this model. I mean, I didn't do it that way at all.
Yeah.
You're going to do another play? You have one up in the...
I got one open right now.
You're running in Three Tall Women.
Three Tall Women.
You're doing Three Tall Women, the Albee play, which I love. And it's you and...
Glenda Jackson.
Glenda.
I know. And Allison Pill, directed by Joe Mantello.
How's that been?
It was a crazy hard rehearsal period.
Why?
I don't know why. Well, I've never done Albee, so for some reason it was I found it very slippery. And again, it's that trap. I started falling into that trap of treating a classic with kid gloves. And so I had to take those gloves off and just sort of play just –
Well, why was it different in terms of my guess is, and this is a very lazy guess, is that his characters are very waspy and very cautious.
Yes.
And they're not as volatile as the characters you often play.
That's a part of it. Yes. Yeah. But it's up and running now, and it was a play that the audience taught us a lot when we finally got an audience in there. They really were the missing piece of the puzzle of this play. And now... It's been very well received and goes through June.
You're never going to give up doing the theater, are you?
Not the theater, no. I could give up the other two, but not the theater. The rush is so visceral when you have those moments.
And when you build it, too, you rehearse, rehearse.
Yeah.
You live it. And then I'm the kind of actor where I'm fantastic 4 weeks after we open. You come see the show halfway. I mean, I'm not ready by the time. I need a lot of rehearsal.
I think that's normal. I feel that I'm not either. I feel like I got to get a few weeks after opening under my belt. So I appreciate a long-ish run.
Now, so once upon a time, you did a TV show. And you did this TV show, and
you mean the Norm Macdonald show?
You did the Norm Macdonald show, that one. That's the one. That was a great show. I love him. He's, by the way, he is fantastic.
He is.
You did the show with Roseanne Barr, and that ran for how many seasons?
Nine.
You ran for nine seasons. Now, that's old school sitcom. You know, nobody runs nine seasons anymore.
No.
You're lucky if you get five. They squeeze out five.
Especially at the 20, 25. And,
right, the old schedule.
Yes.
How would you describe that experience? And you're much younger then.
Yeah.
And the show is a big phenomenon then.
Yeah.
And then you come back.
Uh-huh.
What was it like when you did the show the first time?
The first time? Well, the first time—
Was it just a job?
I didn't know what if it was going to succeed or not. I got offered this pilot. I knew Roseanne as a stand-up. I knew John Goodman had done a lot of theater, but we all didn't know each other. There's three kids on it, you know. And the writers didn't necessarily know how to write for each character. And that was the combination of us doing some initial shows and the writers watching what our strengths were.
Right.
Created those characters.
Interesting.
They saw the strengths. They started writing towards the strengths.
Someone pointed that out to me about Will and Grace when I went on that show. They said, you know, in the first season, if you watched footage, if you watch old episodes of the first season, none of them are really hitting those notes that they hit later
right.
on. They're finding those characters.
Finding them.
That first year,
yeah.
they're stretching and trying
yeah.
to find out what they want to do in terms of the crazy.
That's what it took. And so going back to it, literally 30 years later, I mean from the first preview, from the first pilot, was 30 years ago. From when it went off the air was 20 years ago. So going back to it, and half of the writing crew was the same, and with some new people thrown in. So great people, but like Norm had been on the show, mm-hmm. And so they knew those voices. Well, everybody knew them. What am I saying? Even the new writers knew those voices.
Sure.
And so that was like riding a bike again.
So
and
everybody came back.
Yeah.
Everybody.
Everybody was happy to come back.
What was the young woman's name who played the daughter who was on the talk show? Why am I always forgetting her name?
Sarah Gilbert.
She came back.
Oh, she initiated the whole thing. She had John on her show at the talk.
Right.
And they did a little sketch, like a 20-second sketch of them. They recreated the couch with Afghan, and it was Darlene and John, and Darlene was trying to come out to him, and he just wanted to watch baseball on TV
right.
or something like that. And the audiences thought it was funny. And then they asked John on the show afterwards, would you ever do a reunion show? And he said, of course I would. And then Sarah took that ball and ran with it, called everybody, and it turned in from a reunion show into a little 9-episode arc.
Reboot.
Yep.
Obviously, people have made a big deal, which to me is kind of mystifying to me, about Roseanne Barr's politics and that she's a big Trumpian mm-hmm. and that her character's a Trumpian on the show. When you're doing the show, I would imagine, I get the impression, none of that comes up on the set of the show.
Oh, no.
Everybody's just having a good time.
Yeah.
Let's just get the work done. Let's keep the funny going.
Exactly.
And you know, doesn't bring it up.
No. And they had to address it, you know, how can you not, right. in the pilot,
right.
this new pilot. And I thought they did it really well because, we don't talk about names, but we talk about there's a rift in the family because of how we all voted. The sisters
right.
haven't talked to each other for a year,
right.
which is something that's really going on, you know, across the country.
Right.
That's a totally legit and honest thing to explore. And then what they – it was the same as what they all used to do with all of the stories. They would take a big issue and then shrink it down to the family. So the rift becomes what is it between these two sisters set aside from the election that causes them to, you know, to dysfunction like that.
Right.
So –
when you come back and you have the same group of people and everybody's older, and I mean significantly older. It was
mm-hmm.
many years ago you did this show.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the writers. What about the directors? I mean, did you get some of the directors you had before?
Yeah, we
you
had
did.
Some of the same directors.
No.
Yeah. And the coolest thing is that I thought I would sit on the side watching a scene like between Sarah Gilbert and her kid now, who's on the show, do a scene on the kitchen set, which is a set that Sarah really did grow up on. And now she's parenting her kids on that same set, and Roseanne is in the scene watching her parent, you know, and being very judgmental about it. It's the kind of history between characters that you can't buy. You can cast people together as a family, and they did 30 years ago, but because we spent that decade together, we really did become one. And now as we revisit it, there's these built-in layers because we're back in the same house, and we've had all that time together. So I think it's weirdly deeper the second time around. And the way that Roseanne had always set up that show is that it was the writing, she wanted a kind of writing that was able to support heavy issues. For a sitcom, for a multi-cam sitcom, I don't know of any other one that could go to the places that she did. and bring in a darkness sometimes and really address things and not have it be really jarring for the audience. You know, she just, that was set up perfectly, I think, so that she could address issues that she wanted to as seasons went by.
Until, of course, Roseanne was canceled at the end of May. In an interview in 1995, Laurie said Roseanne should do a play. Quote, I'd like to watch her do something dramatic, like Tennessee Williams or Edward Albee. She'd be brilliant, unquote. While we stay tuned for that, Laurie Metcalf herself can be seen in Albee's Three Tall Women on Broadway until June 24th. I'm Alec Baldwin. You're listening to Here's the Thing from WNYC Studios.